We're at Harvard, the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences, with Daniel Schrag. Dan Schrag is actually Professor of Geology, Sturgis Hooper Professor of Geology here, and also Director of the Harvard University Center for the Environment. So, good to be here.
Glad to have you.
Look, we last talked at the Santa Fe Institute recently, where you are an external fellow, and you delivered one of the Stanislav Ulam lectures in honor of Mary Gell-Mann's 80th birthday. Let me remind you of your title. Twilight of the Anthropocene, the Fate of Civilization in the Face of Environmental Destruction. Sounds pretty dire.
Yes.
Would you like to context that for me?
Well, I actually think the situation is pretty dire. You know, I chose that title because I did want to kind of, in some ways, shock the audience a little bit into thinking about the scale of environmental destruction that surrounds us. You know, if you look at everything from marine life, which has been decimated in the last several centuries, to, you know, land use all over the world, destruction of habitat, and then climate change is sort of the final act, really going to finish things off. As a geologist, I can say quite confidently that what we're going to experience, what our progeny are going to experience over the next century or two, is unlike anything in the history of humankind. It's something that's really geologically extraordinary over millions of years. And what I was ultimately trying to get at in that lecture was the question of the right use for science and technology in that context. I think it was very interesting that Borlaug, who died just a week
Norman
or two
Borlaug,
ago,
yeah.
Norman Borlaug, who was the father of the Green Revolution, in many ways was responsible for another prophecy for being wrong, which was Paul Ehrlich's book, The Population Bomb. He really didn't believe that India could feed itself with more than 200 million people. And what Borlaug did was figured out how to increase the yields from wheat, from rice, by 6 or 10-fold, enough so that India could feed itself even with 1 billion people. But what's interesting about Borlaug is that, I mean, by almost any standard, he's a hero. He saved hundreds of millions of lives. He saved hundreds of millions of people from starvation. And yet some people would say all he did was postpone the tragedy, because India continues to grow at incredibly fast rates. And now we're beginning to see starvation rear its ugly head in India again. Food is a challenge. Just a year and a half ago, we saw India, one of the largest exporters of rice in the world, stop all exports of rice because of a concern over the market. And so there's sort of a question of whether the future, because of human degradation of natural ecosystem services, and ultimately climate change being the grandest scale because it's truly global, whether this leads to a very dire consequence. But what I'm interested in is actually figuring out how to fix it. And there, the question is, do you choose an approach that solves the problem? And how much do you emphasize technologies that can, in some ways, patch the problem but not ultimately solve it?
Well, but let's look at this thing here, first of all. I also want you to explain what Anthropocene is.
Sure.
But you could make the claim that, okay, so here's Paul Ehrlich saying, you know, if you're looking out the window and saying it's the 36th floor, if you jumped out the window and so far so good, a kind of a doom-laden scenario, which turned out not to be the case because along came Norman Borlaug and things got better and so on. So what about all the people who look at the issues that are on the front pages now about global warming and so on and say much the same thing? We'll fix it. You know, stop fretting quite so much.
Well, I'm one of the people who's working. I mean, I'm not working just on the climate side. I'm actually working on the fixing side.
Right.
So I actually develop energy technologies and strategies and think about system engineering for how you actually are going to fix the problem. So we have, you know, everything from energy efficiency to non-fossil technologies to carbon sequestration from large fossil fuel plants, even taking CO2 out of the air artificially, how to do it as cheaply as possible. Turns out it doesn't look like there is a good way to do it very cheaply. All of those things are part of what I think about, and it's from that vantage point that I say that solving this problem is going to be very difficult. And while I'm still spending most of my waking hours working on how to fix it, I have to be honest with myself and admit that there's a possibility, even a likelihood, that this won't work. If you look at where we're heading, we're not doing enough, and not nearly quickly enough. And so, you know, I think it's like friends of mine who work on trying to diminish poverty. You know, it's noble, it's essential, and yet they know that the odds are stacked against them. I think many of us who think about trying to work on a low carbon economy believe that we can do this, but I'm not sure we would say that it's a certainty that we'll succeed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, in the sense that what you're basically saying is that you think that there's no sign of a Norman Borlaug type fix on the horizon.
At least the technologies are there to fix it.
But you'd rather have an insurance.
But they're very expensive. The problem is that the Earth is a slightly different situation. The climate is unusual, even more unusual than the food situation that Ehrlich and Borlaug were dealing with.
Right.
While there was some time scale, you can't develop new crops and get them grown all over India in a year. You can do it over a decade. The Earth system has much longer time scales, much more inertia. So by the time we see catastrophe on the horizon, it may be too late to do anything about it. That's a worry that we have, right, that the thresholds will have been crossed by the time we notice them. So this really calls for some thought. It shouldn't be a distraction from actions to reduce emissions. It shouldn't be a distraction from just fixing it. And again, I'm spending most of my time working on that. At the same time, I think you have to also think about, well, what if things are worse than we think? Are there other things we could do that have not yet been considered? I think it's time to start thinking about that. Not doing anything, and again, not as a distraction. And in fact, many of my colleagues worry that such thinking distracts people's attention from what we need to do to reduce emissions. And that's a risk. At the same time, we're not reducing emissions yet. I hope we are. I hope we will, but we're not yet.
Okay, so what did you mean by this use of the... I thought we lived in the Holocene. What's the Anthropocene?
Well, the Anthropocene was a term that Paul Crutzen coined originally in his acceptance speech for the Nobel Prize. It's a term, though, and variants of it go back all the way to the 19th century. The idea is that... and it is an anthropocentric term, but essentially it describes the state of the Earth where humans have become a dominant force in shaping the planet. Right, and so while the human species was around for 150,000 years or more, and hominids were around for millions of years, they were really part of the ecosystem. They didn't dominate the ecosystem in the way that they did, say, starting 10,000 years ago in North America, when we literally killed all the large animals.
Right.
We completely changed the ecosystem by showing up and hunting.
This is a point you made in your ULAM lecture, though. Right. You showed slides of all these enormous creatures that used to lurch around in America. They were just gone.
That's right. That's right. You know, there's sort of an interesting debate in Guns, Germs, and Steel, which, by the way, I love Jared Diamond's work, and I think that was a fantastic book. In that book, Diamond discusses the megafauna extinction and the human domination of the Earth and human influence on the Earth. And he raises the interesting question of why didn't the megafauna go extinct in Africa? Why are there still so many large animals in Africa? It's really the only place in the world where there are lots of large animals, mm-hmm. large mammals. And it's a very interesting question, isn't it? He came up with an answer, which was that the large animals co-evolved with humans because humans had been there for so long that they had co-evolved and had learned to be afraid of humans, which is sort of an interesting idea, and I suspect it's probably wrong. Because the fact is, humans can hunt elephants pretty well today in Africa. So the elephants may be afraid of humans, but humans are pretty good at hunting elephants. So there's this question, why are there elephants in Africa? Why do they persist? I actually think it's, I think Diamond got it slightly wrong. I think it isn't the coevolution of large animals and humans. I think it's actually the coevolution of things like mosquitoes and humans. You know that the Anopheles mosquitoes that are dominant in Africa, even though malaria is something that occurs worldwide, 90% of the deaths from malaria occur in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa. Mm-hmm. The vectors that are used, the vectors that are the dominant mosquitoes that transmit malaria in Africa are very specific to humans. Their ecology is focused on biting humans. If you offer the Anopheles gambiae or Anopheles arabiensis, the two dominant vectors in Africa, if you allow them to the choice of a cow or a human, they'll bite a human.
Right.
In Asia, this isn't true. They're not specifically targeted towards humans. So while malaria is a problem all over the world, malaria in Africa is a different thing. Think of the sickle cell gene. The sickle cell gene has persisted in Africa for millennia. The sickle cell gene kills half of the offspring, a quarter from being homozygous sickle cell disease, mm-hmm. and a quarter from not having the gene and getting malaria.
Right.
And that's so that two will survive. Think of the malaria burden, the burden of malaria in sub-Saharan Africa, that must have persisted for millennia to allow a gene like that, which kills half of its offspring, to actually be favored. It's extraordinary, isn't
mm-hmm.
it? And so my own suspicion, and again, it's a hypothesis, I'm not sure it's right, is that the reason we have large animals in Africa is because humans never reached critical mass there, that the human populations in Africa never really got dense enough and populous enough to wipe out the large animals. And so it was just that life in Africa is quite difficult for humans, because there are all sorts of things like malaria that are endemic to Africa and really nasty for people.
Mm-hmm. So once you get away from a place where you're being, to misuse the word, decimated, I mean, but reduced in numbers significantly, and you get to increase your population, then you go on a
hunting. Increase your population, you basically wipe out the new ecosystems.
Yeah.
You know, you walk into paradise and you go shopping.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Let's go back to the burden of your talk, though, that the and put it into context, if you wouldn't mind, in terms of the debate that's going on at the moment about global warming.
Is there a debate?
Well, you... All right, so is there not a debate?
Not really. I mean, I think the debate was largely one that was staged by special interest groups. There hasn't been really much of a serious debate in the scientific community for a very, very long time. There's a continuing debate about exactly what the impacts will be and exactly how large the effects will be. But as far as, you know, whether it's happening, the view has been clear for 30 or 40 years. I think it hasn't been clear to people outside of the climate community. And of course, in every community, there are always some skeptics and some naysayers. But the fact is that we've had very strong evidence that CO2 was rising because of fossil fuel burning, and that CO2 was going to warm the climate. The question was how much. Exactly how much, and what sort of amplifiers are in the system, and what the impacts will be. There are some outsiders, you know, people who have never really studied climate science, who aren't aware of the observations, people like Freeman Dyson, for example, who make these claims that, frankly, are just ignorant. I mean, they're just embarrassingly ignorant. where they will say things like, well, this is all based on models. Actually, no. In fact, it's based on very, very good observations. The greenhouse effect is not a theory. It's observed. The greenhouse effect is why Venus is so hot. If you went to Venus today, it would be 460 degrees on the surface of Venus. 460 degrees Celsius. Most people don't realize that although Venus is closer to the Sun and gets twice as much solar radiation as the Earth, it's so bright on the surface that, in fact, if it had the same atmosphere as the Earth, it would be colder than the Earth. And the reason it's so hot on Venus is not because it's closer to the Sun, but because it has a carbon dioxide-rich atmosphere. So, you know, we know that carbon dioxide warms the climate. The question is, on the Earth, exactly how much?
The reason I put it that way is that I see still plenty of websites where the argument is being made that we're using just very recent information, that there are trends, that it will all reverse, and so on and so forth. I hear people who cite to me the work of Richard Lindzen, so on and so forth. So I hear people saying that this doesn't seem to be a settled issue. I know that the general statement is that the scientific community largely agrees it's a settled issue, but plainly the message is still hovering somewhere.
First of all, there's a lot of money involved, right? Energy is arguably the largest industry in the world. If you look at the largest Fortune 500 companies, many of them are energy companies. So there's a lot at stake here. Okay, so I mean, we know that, for example, ExxonMobil was spending $50 million a year, and a variety of other companies were spending huge amounts of money, essentially encouraging liars to confuse the issue. And those of us who were talking out to the public on the other side are university professors. We actually have day jobs. We weren't being paid anything to do this. So I mean, the way I see this, the skeptics on the climate change, I sort of think of them as three types. There are the true skeptics, the people who are honest naysayers. And Dick Lindzen sometimes falls into this category, although I think he gets carried away. He loves the debate so much that he sometimes goes beyond this. And the honest skeptic is one who is just truly a naysayer, is trying to provoke. I'm convinced that if most of the community believed that climate change wasn't happening, Dick Lindzen would be on the other side. Dick Lindzen has questioned whether cigarette smoking causes lung cancer. He is a skeptic. He is a true naysayer. If you say white, he says black. It's partly for the debate and for the challenge of proving the opposite. And many of us admire him for those qualities. I think he crosses the line when he confuses the public, because it's one thing to have scientific skepticism. It's another thing in the policy realm to have skepticism, which isn't to say you're not allowed to bring up objections, but policy really needs to be around risk analysis. And we are way beyond the level of certainty needed to actually say that there's a significant risk of harm coming to society from this. Another type of skeptics are those who are ignorant, and I don't mean that in a cruel way. I mean that people who are generally just not aware of particular aspects of the observations or theory. I believe Freeman Dyson is well-intentioned. I don't believe he has any financial motive or is being paid by anybody. I think he's partly a Dick Lindzen skeptic in that he's just a naysayer, but partly he's ignorant in that he doesn't know. He literally believes that I take him at his word that he believes that climate change is mostly based on models, and that he's right, the models aren't very good. But in fact, it's not true that the reason we believe climate change is happening is because of models. There are many, many, many observations to say that we're in serious trouble. The third class of skeptics, by the way, there are other people who are skeptics who are ignorant in that they may look at one particular part of the system that doesn't quite fit into the framework for thinking about climate change, and they'll say, aha, because my observation doesn't quite fit, therefore the whole thing must be wrong. Okay, you often see this in complex theories.
Right.
Somebody says, I've got proof that it's not true. And when you look, what you would discover is that the interpretation might have been a little wrong and you have to alter it, and suddenly it fits. There was a nice example of this with people who were looking at satellite data that looked at the stratospheric temperatures, or the upper troposphere, upper part of the lower part of the atmosphere, and it was supposed to be warming, and it showed that it was cooling. The satellite data did. For years, one of the champions, skeptics in this realm, said, "Aha! My satellite data show that global warming isn't happening." You say that's odd because all of the other observations around the world seem to be inconsistent with that. It turned out, upon additional investigation, that the satellite measurements in the upper troposphere were contaminated with part of the upper stratosphere. The upper stratosphere, according to greenhouse theory, is supposed to be warming. The stratosphere warms while the troposphere cools, and when you took away that error, suddenly all the data fell into line. So it was a classic example of something not being right, and a handful of people were willing to throw away the entire argument for global warming based on a single observation. So that's another type. The final type is just paid liars, and unfortunately there really are people who are paid to mislead the public. You know, I went and spoke to the Senate a couple of years ago. Senator Inhofe was his last hearing as chair of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. And he was having a discussion of climate change in the media. And so I was there, and he was talking about Kyoto, and he got up and showed a graph showing that that by itself, if you just continued with Kyoto, it would have almost no impact on CO2 emissions in the next 50 years. And I had a very long day listening to this rubbish, and so I interrupted him, which you're not supposed to do in the Senate, but I did anyway, and I said, "Senator, that's really not fair. Of course, I agree that by itself, Kyoto would do very little, but it was only designed to be a first step, followed by a second and a third and a fourth. And so taking it by itself and looking at its impact is really not fair. It was only designed to be a first step." Well, the communications director that worked for Senator Inhofe was a guy named Mark Morano, and who was well known as I think he worked for Rush Limbaugh before, and then after that, he was the journalist who broke the story on the Swift boat scandal with John Kerry. So this guy is a paid hack, right? And he led the press release from the Senate briefing, the Senate committee meeting, with a statement saying, "Professor Schrag from Harvard University, who believes that climate change is real, even he admitted that Kyoto would do nothing." Completely twisting my words out of context. This is the real world. It's a rough and tumble world. And that's what we're up against in terms of, you know, people who have huge financial incentives to misconstrue the information. So it's not surprising to me that there is the perception of a debate, but scientifically, there is really no debate. I mean, if you think about risk analysis, there's no question about it. You know, we can look at pictures of the Arctic, for example. Arctic sea ice is gone. You know, this year, a commercial ship went through the Northeast Passage. That's extraordinary. It's called the fabled Northeast Passage. Northeast Passage doesn't exist, except it does now. Northwest Passage has been open for several years now. The idea that you and I could take a 20-foot sailboat through the Northwest Passage is you know, makes what Amundsen did seem trivial. And yet he suffered for 3 years to get through there. It was heroic. It was a very different world than when he was living. So, you know, anybody who looks at the Arctic and says climate change isn't real and isn't happening, I don't know what they're thinking about.
When you talk about risk analysis, we've sort of had this conversation probably before, that I'm argued to you that what the public seems to want from science, probably mistakenly, is certitude. And that when they see stories which reveal uncertainty, the whole enterprise is then under some suspicion. You know, you see, read a newspaper report about something not having changed over 3 months, 6 months, whatever.
Well, I think actually the press is partly responsible for this. Communicating uncertainty to the public is very important. And the irony is, I actually believe the uncertainty in the climate problem is in fact the reason to be scared, not the reason to be reassured. For decades, the typical climate change story in the media, even good journalists at places like the New York Times, would follow a, you know, they would talk to some scientist about some new observation that showed that climate change was happening, and then they would have a quote from somebody who didn't believe it, mm-hmm. as if this was, you know, a two-party system where they got equal time. First of all, it's absolutely fine to talk to multiple people with different points of view, but you would hope that that portrayal would actually reflect the kind of true nature of the debate within the community. And instead, what you end up with, if you look back over the media, is that the media constantly portrays this as a theory, as an idea, as a hypothesis, confusing the public into thinking that this is a legitimate disagreement. When in fact, if you look at the scientific literature, there's really no disagreement at all. Most of the people who were brought in to question the interpretations had no standing in the scientific community working on climate. They didn't publish on climate change. They had strong opinions. They were maybe retired physicists or some, you know, people from think tanks in Washington. It's not the same. Dick Lindzen is an exception in that regard. But again, if you look at the frequency that Dick Lindzen is quoted in media reports compared with, to take an average climate scientist, you know, he's highly overrepresented in terms of his standing in the community. And that's a problem of journalists. But more important than that is just the general idea that the public is not very good at understanding scientific uncertainty. The scientific uncertainty in the climate change problem is huge. You have to realize no human being has ever seen carbon dioxide levels as high as they are today. It's never been observed. So we're doing an experiment that we haven't done for millions of years. And the idea that any climate scientist like me is so smart, so insightful to actually understand the Earth in all its complexity, to know exactly what's going to happen, that's ridiculous. There's no way that can happen. And therefore, there will be surprises. And I guarantee you, we will be wrong. We'll be wrong a lot of the time. I think what's interesting to ask is, in which direction are we likely to be wrong? And when you actually think about that question, it turns out that there are many reasons to believe that we scientists are quite conservative. We generally publish things only with 95% confidence intervals. I was testifying in Washington once with a general, former four-star general, chief of staff of the Army, who said, you know, all this stuff about certainty, he said, boy, in the Army, if we waited until we were even 50% certain, we would lose lives. We look at the trends, and we use our best judgment, and that's how we make decisions. Mm-hmm. And I think that he's right. You know, we apply one standard for national security and this other standard for climate change. You know, what I love to quote, and this is a little bit of just old-fashioned politics, but, you know, the Cheney Doctrine. Have you heard of the Cheney Doctrine? Cheney Doctrine regarding weapons of mass destruction, which is that even if there is only a 1% chance that a country has nuclear weapons, you should treat it as an absolute certainty. Sort of an interesting discussion of risk and uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Do you subscribe to that?
Well, no, I actually don't. But I think it's interesting that he says, that Vice President Cheney said, we need to be, if you think there's even a 1% chance that a country has nuclear weapons, you should treat it like an absolute certainty. And yet on the climate change, which is arguably just as much of an impact on human society, he said, oh, we need scientists to be 100% certain before we even think about acting. Right? It's sort of a very strange dichotomy there.
Well, there is this dichotomy. In fact, just to go back to the point I was making about, on the one hand, I was arguing, or at least making suggesting that the sense that there is certitude delivered by science is bogus, mistaken, it's bad news, and we should be pointing out that there's, you know, it's a tendency towards a search for truth sort of thing.
Well, I mean, I think it's dangerous to hide behind the unanimity of the scientific community.
Right.
In other words, I don't go around and say, I believe in climate change because 1,000 of my colleagues do.
Yeah, but my point was...
I actually, by the way, am driven to be, if you look at my work in the past, I love to be contentious. I love to try to come up with controversial ideas.
Oh, really?
And so if I could actually show that climate change wasn't happening, first of all, do you know how famous I would be?
You'd be all over it.
I would be all over it. All the incentives go in that direction. The suggestion by some in this, you know, you hear this occasionally in Congress, that somehow climate scientists are all saying that climate change is real so that we can get grants to study it or something like that. And you say, first of all, I don't actually know that I've ever gotten a grant to study climate change. I study the geochemistry of the ocean millions of years ago. I study the snowball Earth 700 million years ago. I don't think I've ever gotten a grant to study climate change. And by the way, if I could make climate change go away as a problem, if I could prove that it was wrong, I'd have enough grant money for the rest of my career and then some. So all the incentives go the other direction. It's just, unfortunately, it's not where the evidence points.
So my point was this, though, that although I'm advocating being honest by pointing out the fallibilities of science, that's not necessarily a good strategy, according to somebody like Chris Mooney and Matthew Nesbitt, who wrote this article on framing science, in which they pointed out that to contend misleading scientific claims, you have to avoid technical language and frame scientific issues by emphasizing shared values, and that even emphasizing something like scientific uncertainty gives the opposition, as it were, ammunition.
I disagree. I actually think it's a big mistake to start doing defensive science in that way, or defensive communication. And I've got to say, I understand why people think that, because it's really changed in the last 5 years. Mm. Noticeably, actually, since Al Gore's film. But over the last 15 years, the fact is, every time you got up in Washington or you went to the newspaper, there was a skeptic, somebody, Dick Lindzen, Fred Singer, somebody like that, sitting across from you, talking rubbish. And so you had to take a certain defensive posture, because you were always in this silly debate. And it was really silly. I actually think that the right way to deal with this is not to try to distill it down. Many people say, we should just say things more clearly in absolute terms and not give the nuances. I think that's a dangerous mistake. I think this is tried in a lot of fields. You know, I had a friend who was working with people who were making predictions of El Nino, and they were using that to tell poor farmers in Africa whether there would be droughts. And there was a lot of belief that the poor farmers in Africa couldn't really handle probabilistic forecasts, and so they just needed to be told either there will be a drought or there won't be a drought. But of course, then suddenly you're taking a lot of responsibility for being right. A friend of mine went and actually played games of chance with farmers in Africa, with subsistence farmers, and discovered they're quite good at probability. They understand. They know how to bet. And so if you actually tell them there's a 60% chance of a drought, they know what to do. And it's actually much better to tell them that and let them make their decisions than telling them there's going to be a drought, you need to do this, you need to plant this crop or not plant that crop. Mm. Because suddenly you have a much greater responsibility and you have to treat them with respect. And I actually think treating the public with respect, in terms of even if they're not educated on science, I think treating them with respect in their ability to understand scientific uncertainty is very important. So the way I like to talk to them about it is explaining to them what the risks are and taking uncertainty seriously. And I find that a much better approach.
In terms of where we're talking about here, the Harvard University Center for the Environment, I mean behind you actually is the Museum of Natural History.
Yeah.
Peabody is, we could wander through
the
here
ghost
and
get of to, get, all to around, yeah.
get to the all this interconnectedness of the various disciplines, which I think you've encouraged in that sort of Santa Fe Institute area that you've created over there. Plainly, you're a believer in I assume, in building bridges
sure.
between disciplines. Could you tell me something about the Center for the Environment? Is that a relatively new initiative, or?
It's not new, but it was sort of reborn about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, many centers turn out to be little fiefdoms. And when I was asked to become director of the Center for the Environment, I realized, you know, I already had a laboratory. I didn't really want a fiefdom. What I love about Harvard is that this is an amazing intellectual community.
Yeah.
You have people from the Kennedy School, from the Business School, from the Law School, from the School of Public Health, from the Sciences, from Engineering, Medicine, I mean, all over. And what's interesting about this is that in climate change, you actually need all of them.
Yeah, because
you need the economists, you need the health people, you need the law,
lawyers. It's a public justice issue.
Yes, it's all of these things. You know, you want to talk about international development, you want to talk about even religion. I mean, you want to really talk to India and China about intergenerational equity issues. You've got to really understand some of these. So this is an incredibly complex problem. And so you have to be able to engage with people. And so the Center for the Environment really took the mode of being a service organization, not an institute to do work on this, but with the realization that Harvard is a place full of prima donnas, full of superb faculty who have big egos, and I am no exception. And therefore, rather than trying to lead them, which turns out to be very difficult, because if you say, hey, follow me, everybody will say, have a good time. We're going to go do our own thing. Mm. Instead, what if you say, here are some interesting questions. How can I help you do what you want to do? But in relation to this space.
Right.
And it turns out there, you get a very different response, especially if you have a bit of a thick skin and you can tolerate some interesting individuals and personalities. And so as a result, for me, it's just this is just a academic playground. There's just incredible number of interesting people that are worth the time invested in engaging with them and encouraging them.
Yeah.
So the Center for the Environment just encourages interactions, but in a very organic way. We don't force people. If people want to go off and do their own thing, great, good luck to them. But if they want to interact with people across this campus, we try to lower the barriers. We try to make it easier for them to do that.
And how did you get into science in the first place? Was it scientific family background? Or?
Not so much. I my father's a physician. My mother is an attorney. I was good at science, and so I continued doing it. I went to college and started studying physics and discovered I wasn't very good at physics. I was okay, but I came to the realization. I was at Yale. And I took a course that was too hard for me and realized that although I was very, very good, I was part of the elite group just getting into this course, that I was struggling and there were people who were sailing. And that's a good experience to learn, that you have your limits. I think many people learn that at some point in their later teens or early 20s. And that, I think, pushed me away from science for a while. So in college, I spent a lot of time studying political philosophy and political theory. And at the same time, I started studying geology because I didn't want to give up on science. And I had an interesting interaction with a handful of faculty. And it was a wonderfully nurturing department. And I went to graduate school in geology mostly because I wanted to go work in Washington, so I thought I would get a master's degree and go work in Washington. And really, when I was out at Berkeley as a graduate student, I came across both a wonderful group of peer graduate students, but also a couple of scientists who reminded me how much pleasure you can get from working on a scientific problem. And they reminded me how much fun science could be.
They would be?
Two of my PhD advisors, Donald Apollo from Berkeley and a guy named Frank Richter from Chicago. And both of them were just wonderfully intellectually generous. And so they had a wonderful sense of curiosity and passion for what they were doing. And it was infectious. And so I just forgot about the future and just worked on my science. And then all of a sudden, you know, I was offered a faculty position at Princeton and you know, suddenly opportunities came along. So it was a wonderful place to train, actually. You know, I had enormous freedom.
It puts me in mind of a question that I often ask of people, which at this point, there are a couple of books that have roughly the same title. One was by Ramon y Cajal, and one by Peter Medawar, and they're both sort of advice to a young scientist. Having gone through this process yourself and described it, what would be your advice to a young scientist?
Well, I've got to say, I hate books like that. When I got out of graduate school and I was on my way to Princeton, I remember Science published a piece by Watson on advice to young scientists. And it was so condescending. And I sort of felt like saying, boy, advice to a young scientist, be in the right laboratory, discover DNA at age, whatever, 25, win a Nobel Prize, and that's how you succeed in science. You know, what does this guy have to tell anybody about how to succeed in science? Just not fair. Now, of course, that's not fair to Jim Watson, but there is this sort of condescension that you hear in that. And so I'm cautious giving advice to anybody because I wouldn't suggest anybody try to recreate my path. I got very good advice from an undergraduate professor I had, who was not a particularly great scientist. He was a wonderful teacher, but he wasn't all that brilliant a researcher. Hadn't actually done research for many years. But he said to me, Dan, you should go to graduate school, even if you only go for a couple of years, because the process of immersion in something steepens your learning curve so much that you cannot even imagine now making the sort of decisions you'll be able to make 2 years from now. Your understanding will be so much deeper mm-hmm. that you will completely reframe your universe. And that was right. The immersion process of graduate school is very special. And so I often repeat that advice to students, that going beyond the undergraduate years in the US, where you're really quite diffuse, and focusing on something for a couple of years is a wonderful experience. Even if you decide that you don't want to do a PhD afterwards, that process of immersion in a discipline is a wonderful thing. You know, I'm often asked about interdisciplinary education because I am so interdisciplinary. I dabble in economics and in engineering and technology. My core discipline is geochemistry, and I still am passionate about understanding geochemical cycles in the earth and using geochemistry to decode the history of climate. But my core strength is in geochemistry, and yet I'm working on power plants and on synthetic fuels and on policy issues. And so people ask me, well, shouldn't we be training students in interdisciplinary education? And I think we should be, but very cautiously, because I think it's very important for people to have the immersion in some core strength. There's nothing stopping people from being curious and expanding. Life is long. PhD is not the end of your scientific career, it's just the beginning. And so there's absolutely no reason that you can't do as I have done and explore dozens of different fields. You know, every student, every new PhD student I take on works in almost a completely different area. And so, you know, we joke that sometimes it's hard to have group meetings in my lab because everybody's working in a completely different field. But actually, it means that everybody's very rich and broad and still very narrow. They're an expert in one area. Mm. So the way we've tried to do interdisciplinary education at Harvard on energy and environment is not a PhD program on energy and environment. I think that would be a tragedy. You know, a lot of these started in the 70s, and some of them are still around. I frankly don't think they're very good. I think people aren't well trained. What we decided to do was take the PhD students who were already here in chemistry and earth sciences and mathematics and economics and law and business, whatever, and give them a little breadth. Give them an exposure to some of the issues. Again, they're PhD students, you can treat them with respect. They're independent scholars, or they're on the way to becoming independent scholars. So you can give them some exposure, not a complete knowledge, but you give them some exposure. We make them, as part of this program, take three courses, a course in energy technology, a course in energy policy, and a course on the consequences of energy. And they meet with different faculty during the semester from around the university, from different disciplines. But they're still in their PhD program. They're still doing their dissertation in chemistry or in economics or in whatever their field might be. We don't want to take them out of that. We want them to be the best at that. We want them to be the best economist or the best physicist or the best chemist or the best earth scientist they can possibly be. But giving them a little bit of an introduction early in their career encourages them to maybe take a route that I have taken only after I left graduate school.
Right. Do a search on you, and your name comes up always associated with Snowball Earth. Do you want to
sort
explain?
Sort of funny. So that? Snowball Earth is one of these ideas that is so spectacular that it's hard for people to avoid it. It just captures people's imaginations. And I've got to say, I was very fortunate to be part of that discovery. It was one of the most exciting times scientifically for me. And there's still so many questions about it. It's like, and I'm starting to work on it again after a sort of hiatus of a little while. The Snowball Earth is a theory that says that the at various times in Earth history, the most recent one about 600 million years ago, the Earth froze over completely. Equator to pole. There were cracks. It wasn't completely solid. There were places where there are volcanoes and hot springs and places where the ice was melted. But essentially, the Earth was virtually ice-covered, and that glaciation lasted for millions, maybe even more than 10 million years. And people thought this was extraordinary, except we have unbelievably good evidence that this happened, not just once, but several times in Earth history. And what's so interesting about it is it's associated with very interesting transitions, biological transitions in the Earth. The most recent one being immediately after the last snowball glaciation is the rise of multicellular animals. It's when animals got large, multicellular, and suddenly changed the world.
The Cambrian.
The Cambrian explosion just follows that.
Exactly. Is after that. So you're telling me.
The Ediacaran
right.
periods just after the snowball glaciation, immediately followed by the Cambrian explosion. Right. So I'm working right now on a theory that the snowball glaciations led to a jump in atmospheric oxygen. There's some evidence that both times in Earth history when we think oxygen went from a low state to a high state. So if you look at the history of atmospheric oxygen, very early on, we believe the Earth had essentially no oxygen. And then starting around 2.2 billion years or so, it jumped up and had a little bit of oxygen, maybe one or maybe a few percent of modern oxygen. For most of the Proterozoic, from about 2.2 billion to about 600 million years. And then after 600 million years, all the animals got big, and we interpret that as suddenly oxygen was much higher. 10-20% of the atmosphere like it is today, allowing animals to get large. Because really it's very difficult to be multicellular if oxygen isn't higher in the environment. It's just too hard to do respiration at a cellular level if you're large, if there's not a lot of oxygen around. So what I'm working on is a theory that explains how the snowball glaciation actually perturbs the geochemical cycle of oxygen such that it actually causes the oxygen to jump up.
Now this was a theory that was developed with
Paul Hoffman.
How has it stood up so far to...
You know, it was actually fascinating to watch because the Snowball Earth for me was one of a dozen things I was doing. So while it's well known, there are a lot of other things that I'm well known for too in other communities. Carbon sequestration or studies of the glacial maximum using pore waters or coral geochemistry or all sorts of other things that have nothing to do with each other. And so for me, I could watch it with a little bit more distance because I had lots of other things to do. This was sort of like a hobby.
It has a good title, though.
It's a wonderful title. We didn't invent the title, by the way. Joe Kirschfink invented the title.
Joe Kirschfink? The Caltech?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Didn't he work on bacteria?
Well, he was interested in... He's a paleomagnetic guy.
Magnetic
fields. He studies the magnetic signature of rocks that indicate... and he's interested in paleomagnetism and life and biology and biomagnetism.
Right.
But the way he got involved in this was he was studying the magnetic signature of rocks near these glaciations because some people said these were on the equator. And Joe said, no, that has to be wrong. So he went and studied them, and sure enough, he became a believer. And so he wrote one of the first papers on this, calling it Snowball Earth. But he never really believed it himself. It wasn't until Paul Hoffman and I wrote this paper in 1998 that really caught the fascination of the community. Because what we did was we brought new observations to bear, several lines of evidence that suddenly made everything look really crystal clear. Now, what was so fascinating was, I imagine this must have been how Walter Alvarez and Louis Alvarez felt after they proposed the meteorite impact hypothesis that killed the dinosaurs. We got enormous amount of praise and enormous amount of hostility. And what was so interesting was that many of the people who both loved us and hated us, and it was really quite personal as well. I mean, it was, you know, personal attacks on us both. It was quite clear from talking to them that they didn't even understand some of the issues and some of the observations and some of the interpretations. They had this very simplistic view. And so many people reacted to it either because they hated new ideas or they loved new ideas. It's so crazy it must be right, or it's so crazy it must be wrong. Mm-hmm. And it takes a little time for the community to process the information. And since then, over the last 5 years, a number of people have come up with even new observations that we hadn't even thought of that strongly support our original ideas. So I think overall, it's, you know, there's still some people who just wish we would never proposed it and hate the idea and wish it would go away. Many of them are people who have studied this time period for many, many years and felt like we kind of invaded their quiet space. You know, here they were, geologists, and although I call myself a geologist, I'm a geochemist, but Snowball Earth is really a different planet, right? It's thinking about the Earth. You have to understand geology, geochemistry, geophysics, atmospheric sciences, oceanography, atmospheric chemistry. You have to really understand the entire Earth system. Now, most Precambrian geologists go out in the field and map and collect samples, and they don't think about all these disciplines. This is really a more modern view of Earth sciences, integrated view of oceanography, atmospheric sciences, which used to not even be part of geology departments. And I think the Snowball Earth theory forces people, you know, you can't really critique the Snowball Earth theory if you don't understand the geochemistry, and you can't really critique it if you don't understand the oceanography or the glaciology or the atmospheric chemistry. And that's a lot. That's very hard. And so, you know, it was also such a dominant idea that they couldn't even ignore it. So there are a lot of people who were just hostile to it because I think we invaded their space. Overall, though, what's important about it is it makes some predictions that are ultimately going to be testable. And it has led to new observations and a lot of new thinking. And to me, well, Paul Hoffman and I said this to each other a decade ago. We said, boy, if this is wrong, there are so many extraordinary observations that need to be explained, and we think we do a good job of explaining all of them. But if we're wrong, boy, wouldn't it be great to think of the alternative, because it must be even better. You know?
So one of the points that came up in conversation that I had earlier with Steven Pinker, one of your Harvard colleagues, was precisely about this notion of public perception of how science is done. And this misunderstanding of the various stories out there, the Kuhnian notion of normal science, and then there's a paradigm shift, or a Popperian description of things have to be falsifiable, but, you know, several things aren't, and so it's confusing trying to work through the history and philosophy of science and trying to figure out exactly what scientists are doing. Here you're talking about an idea that comes up that creates enormous turbulence in the community, and as you said, personal attacks, pro and con. It's a very dynamic kind of enterprise.
Yes. And one, I mean, my guess is that had Paul's and my personalities been different, we might have seen different results too. We both have big personalities. Paul is a little more irascible than I am, but we are both strong personalities. And I'm sure that rubbed the people the wrong way as well. It was really a very personal side to this, and I was surprised by that.
Let me just mention, because I do want to keep on this tack for a moment here. There was a survey recently by the Pew organization, which looked at, surveyed both the public and, unusually for this time, scientists as well, through the AAAS, American Association for the Advancement of Science, about attitudes. And the overview here is public praises science, scientists fault public media. And basically, as usual, public was very pro-science, got a bunch of things wrong, didn't know some of the details, even some larger issues. But scientists' views of the problems for science, the major problem was that the public does not know very much about science. 85% of them sort of thought that.
Well, and I think that's probably true. That doesn't the same as faulting them. Science is complicated. And for most people, I wish people understood scientific method. I wish people understood about data analysis and evidence and all of the things that we think about when we think about science. But the fact is, for many people, it doesn't really engage with their experience of the world all that much. So while I think it's probably true that a large fraction of the public are not terribly literate when it comes to science, that doesn't mean that I necessarily fault them for it. If anything, I think I fault scientists for not being as good educators as we could be. I mean, the fact is, historically, we've been terrible elitists and educators. Think of physics classes, I remember, like the one I was in college, where the whole point was to weed out 99% and find the one or two brilliant theorists who might be hiding in your class. What a terrible way to educate students. What a terrible way to encourage them to be curious about the world, about how to think about the world in scientific terms. So I think that's changing, and I think it's changed a lot. So much effort has gone into good science education over the last couple of decades, but we still have a long way to go, clearly. Press is a little bit different. You know, the press on science, and I have a good friend, Corey Dean, who's a former science editor of the New York Times, and we spar with each other in a friendly way on this issue periodically. She always talks about how scientists are very poor at communicating to journalists. And that, I think, is probably true. At the same time, she likes to tell the story of how she was made the science editor of the New York Times because somebody saw her carrying a Scientific American once, which turned out not even to be hers. She claims it's a true story. To me, that's a sign of the problem. You know, when science journalists get stories wrong, there's no consequences. Whereas if you're a reporter on Wall Street in the financial section and you really blow a story, you get it wrong, and as a result a stock collapses or whatever, you know, you're quite careful. Same with political reporters. Political reporters, there are consequences for them blowing their stories. Their reputations are shattered. Not so in the scientific community of scientific reporting.
You don't think so? Why would that be? Why is there a difference?
I think it's that we don't, you know, the number of times I've had bad science articles written about things, and you just throw up your hands and say, well, maybe they spelled my name right, and you walk away.
Right, I've heard that.
You don't call the editor angry demanding an apology, right? You don't have a public declaration against them. It's not the same. It's not as high profile. It's the consequences of getting it wrong are less in the scientific journalism. It is considered normal, for example, the New York Times, which has arguably the best scientific journalism team in the world. It is considered normal that many of them do not have science education, any kind of science degree. That is extraordinary. Could you imagine sending somebody to report on Wall Street who had no economics, who had nothing, knew nothing about finance? They wouldn't do that. Or sending somebody to report on sports who didn't know the rules of baseball or football? It wouldn't happen. And so the idea that you can send any reporter who can just write well to go talk to a scientist, and that the scientist has the obligation of distilling the information down to a level that the reporter should be able to understand without any training seems to really take away the responsibility from the journalist as the translator. It seems to me that it's the journalist who should be able to talk to the scientist and then explain to the public why, what that scientist is thinking about, that he or she is doing something interesting or extraordinary, and the fascination involved in that process. Too often you see a ping pong article, you know, this scientist says this, that scientist says that, but it gives no sense to the public of why this is such an important area.
This is off the newsstands now. I know you're interested in energy and coal. There's E Magazine. Is this the end for coal? I assume this is a cover designed to sell. But what do you take away from that cover? Is that Daryl Hannah?
I see Stop Mountaintop Removal on her shirt.
Right.
Mountaintop removal is a horrible thing, but that most coal doesn't come from mountaintop removal. I mean, you know, this is not a science piece, right? This is
It's an environmental magazine, though. It's out there on the newsstands. I'm not singling this out to be castigated. I'm just saying that in general, I was infuriated the other day when I saw a recent copy of Newsweek that had on the cover, "Is your child racist?" Well, I think that was a reference to the book by Poe Bronson and his colleague that's recently about new evidence from the scientific community about the effects of nurture and so on and so forth. But
no, it's terrible. I mean, so for example, I'm on PCAS, President Obama's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, and a subset of our group put together a report on H1N1 for the president that was released a month ago or so. It got quite a lot of press. The report said that there would be between, I forget the numbers exactly, but I think it was between 30 and 90,000. They didn't even make a prediction. They said, we looked at scenarios and we think a scenario is that between 30 and 90,000 people could die of H1N1 in the U.S. They made it very clear that an average flu season is about 35 or 40,000 deaths. So it could be quite a bit worse, but not 100 times worse than regular flu season. It could be a little bit better because it seems to be a mild strain of the flu for most people. Not for everybody, but for most people. If you then looked at the headlines after the report was released, it said, President's Council says up to 90,000 people could die from swine flu. With no context of 90,000 is really only twice as many as die every year. You know, no scale, and of course the public doesn't understand that. That's just blatant sensationalism. That's a classic journalist flaw. You know what? It's a shame, but I gotta say, newspapers are in tough straits these days. They're trying to sell papers. It's a business, and I think that's the true answer. But you know what? I can't fix journalism. What I can do is communicate better to the public and to journalists and help them explain to the public better about climate change. So that's, and about energy technology, and that's what I try to do.
So in addition to your scientific responsibilities, connections, your research, you mentioned as you were going through your education that you had a strong interest in politics, you were involved in politics, and that seems to have come together as you have become a member this year of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology, PCAST.
Yeah. I've got to say it's a great honor and a wonderful joy for me. I mean, this is sort of kind of where I hoped I might someday get to, and it's delightful to be here earlier than I expected.
Well, there wasn't a place to get, almost wasn't a place to get to.
There was no place. For the last 8 years, there hasn't been advice to scientific advice, at least not through the conventional channels. My suspicion is the Pentagon had probably good scientific advisors. So there was science getting into Washington in various ways, but science was treated as part of the political process for the last 8 years, and it's so refreshing to see a change in that regard.
Yeah. The president in his, I've asked a number of people this question, in his inaugural address and later an address to the National Academies, has used this phrase about restoring science to its rightful place. And I've been asking a number of people what the coordinates of that place are.
Yeah.
What are we talking
Well,
about?
I think what President Obama meant, at least what I think he meant, I have no idea exactly what he meant by that, but what I think President Obama meant is that in Washington, it was a very context-specific statement, that in Washington, over the last 8 years, science was really regarded as something that was malleable to suit whatever the political winds were. If you wanted science to come out and say that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, wonderful. If you wanted science to say that a small biological weapons program that tried to produce some anthrax was exactly equivalent to a nuclear weapon, science would support you in that. And they basically saw science as something to be used to achieve a political end, as opposed to something that should constrain, be brought into the decision-making process to make just and intelligent and wise decisions to help guide our country through a complex maze of obstacles, of challenges of all sorts. Security challenges, energy challenges, economic challenges, environmental challenges. So my sense of what President Obama was saying was that we really were going to restore science to the place where it could actually inform policymaking, but not be put on some kind of a pedestal as absolute or superior to other areas. Economics is important. You know, we don't have infinite amount of money. We know that now. We can't just throw money around the world. We have to be careful. We have to think about our economy. So good economics is important. Good science is important. Good understanding of cultures is important, as we've also learned from the last several years of experience in engaging with the world. And so I didn't feel like it was restore its rightful place relative to other areas, as some people I think have interpreted it. I think it's rather restore science to a place where it can inform policymaking and inform decisions in Washington without just being used as a political football.
Okay, I have two points there. There was also, coincidentally, in the summer of 2009 in the journal Issues in Science and Technology, a piece by Dan Sarowitz, who's at ASU, Arizona State University, which coincidentally was called The Rightful Place of Science, and he looked at the Democratic Party's enthusiastic embrace of science, and there's a pull-out quote here, which used some of the language you used. Perhaps we've now discovered the rightful place of science, not on a pedestal, not implausibly insulated from politics and disputes about morality, but nestled within the bosom of the Democratic Party. Is this a good place for science to be? 2 points there. One, is that the reference to the Democratic Party necessary, or is
well,
this why?
So, I mean, I know some people who are very worried that that the association with the Democratic Party means that the scientific establishments, NSF, NASA, NOAA, et cetera, would be very vulnerable if a Republican administration were to take over. I hope that that's not true. You know, I know scientists who are Republicans. I know most scientists are Democrats. But frankly, given the last administration, who were so thoroughly hostile to science, so thoroughly unscientific, whether it was the intelligent design discussion or the climate change discussion, you know, the idea that, and this was at least the story that I heard from many reliable sources, I don't know whether this is true, but that the president's science advisor was chosen because they had to agree with the president on three important issues, that they had to believe that stem cell research was bad, that they had to believe that missile defense was possible and good, and they had to believe that climate change was false. That's a very tough triple cocktail to swallow for a scientist. So no wonder it was very difficult to find anybody to fill that job. I heard that they offered it to many people who turned them down. That's what I mean. I think that's maybe what Sarowitz means. But as far as the alliance with the Democrats, I think that's because of the last administration. There's nothing permanent or serious about that. In fact, I really hoped, and I used to talk about this to the public, the last election I said, you know, and until John McCain picked his running mate, who questioned climate change, I said, you know, climate change shouldn't be a partisan issue. If you look in Europe, it's not a partisan issue. In Germany, you have Angela Merkel, conservative, who thinks climate change is a serious problem. The Tories and Labour in the UK are not disagreeing about climate change. They're disagreeing about strategies to fight it, but they're not disagreeing on whether it's happening. The science isn't the football here. There are strategies. There are real differences in strategies.
Although there was a television program in England that was talked about the global warming hoax.
There was, but it wasn't the official stance of the Tory party.
Right, that's true.
Whereas it was the official stance of the Republican Party. And that's a very big difference. And so really, I was optimistic when John McCain ran against either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama that we were going to get beyond this. Suddenly, climate change was not going to be a partisan issue anymore. And clearly that was naive. When he picked his running mate, suddenly we saw questioning whether or not climate change was really caused by humans. How anybody in Alaska could believe that is extraordinary. If you go up there and look at what's happening in Alaska. And in the Senate, you know, it's just straight party lines. I'm very unfortunate.
Maybe be slightly contentious here. What's wrong with putting science on a pedestal? What else would you put on a pedestal?
Well, you know, I have no objection to being a philosopher king, but I think it's a dangerous thing. And so, you know, when it comes to making decisions about technology or science, scientists don't have the only vote. And when I think about in Washington, at least, putting science on a pedestal, I think that's depends on what you mean by that. If you mean allowing them to actually make policy by saying, here is the answer. If that's what you mean by a pedestal, then I think that's bad. If you mean showering them with resources to make sure that we have healthy scientific and technological innovation in this country, which is a driver for prosperity, then I think it's a wonderful thing. So it really depends on what you mean by a pedestal.
Okay, so tell me now, if you would, please, not what you thought President Obama meant by the rightful place of science, but if I asked you ab initio, what do you think is the rightful place of science?
I think science is a great source of innovation, and certainly in an economic sense can be a huge driver for new ideas, new technologies that can improve human welfare. And so I think we need to publicly support it. We need to publicly encourage our students to learn it. And that support needs to be large and persistent. It can't be subject to the whims of a particular political administration. That's the rightful place that I would like to see science. In terms of the policymaking process, I would like to see many, many access points, as I think you have in this current administration, where scientific insights can be brought to bear to make sure that the people who are making decisions are technically literate, or if not, have really good technical people working with them who can help explain some of the technical issues to them, so that decisions can be made that incorporate some of the best ideas. That doesn't mean to say that scientists will always determine the answer. Many decisions are made for economic or political or social reasons. But I think at least we can ask that our decision makers, our leaders, are aware of the technical and scientific constraints. That's the rightful place for science. Sure. I mean, I think there are so many examples of ways that global warming or climate change can affect security. A nice example is the Indus River that drains the Himalayas and flows through India into Pakistan. We know that India and Pakistan are not exactly friendly, and they are both owners of nuclear weapons. Climate change may cause the Indus to drop in volume substantially, maybe even 30 to 50% over the next century. Which Indus is really the lifeblood of Pakistan. Mm. What do you think happens if both India and Pakistan are dry and there are accusations of taking too much water from India since they are upstream from Pakistan? I think climate change, it's a nice example because rarely do I think climate change will be the sole source of provocation for a security issue. But I think in areas where you already have high tension, complex societies with problems, climate change may just be the straw that breaks the camel's back. We already see that in Sudan. You know, in Darfur, you would never say that Darfur is a climate change problem. And yet to ignore the effect of drought in Darfur and the fight for water resources as a component of what's happening in Darfur would be naive as well. And so another example, I mean, you can look at what happened in the 60s when Suhartos took over from Sukarno in Indonesia. There's that wonderful old movie, one of the good Mel Gibson movies, Year of Living Dangerously with Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver, where what's happening is Sukarno is in control, but he's getting weaker. The communists are rising to power because there's a drought. It turns out there's a big El Nino going on. There's a huge drought in Southeast Asia. They actually had to blockade an island and actually prevent food from going in because they didn't have enough food to feed everybody. And there were chants of Sukarno, feed your people. And the communists came to power and ultimately threw Sukarno out. This was part of the concern about the domino theory, why we were in Vietnam at the time. Of course, what happened was Suharto, who was one of Sukarno's generals, had a counter coup and then slaughtered 200,000 communists. And so the communist coup failed, and ultimately then Suharto took over and ruled Indonesia for the next 30 years. But the lesson is that, you know, would I say that El Nino and climate caused that event? No. Would I say that climate added tension to an already complex, tense situation? Yes. And so I think that's the role for climate and national security. I think climate will add additional stress on already stressed societies, mm-hmm. and the result may be a variety of national security outbreaks. You know, I just don't want to see what happens if India and China start fighting over water resources, or India and Pakistan. I just think that's a bad experiment to do.
I note, in fact, that the president's science advisor is John Holdren, who's obviously well known for atmospheric science. Jane Lubchenco, now at NOAA.
Yeah, it's a crowded administration when it comes to scientists. It's wonderful.
Steve Koonin, was former chief scientist at BP.
Yeah, provost at Caltech.
Steve Chu is not exactly unfamiliar with energy issues. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a packed administration.
It's wonderful, isn't it?
Well, I'm asking you.
Well, it makes it difficult to be on a president's council of advisors because he has so many good scientific advisors. You know, back in the Clinton administration, John Holdren was on PCAST, and he was really the go-to guy on climate change and energy. He was the guy. Nobody on PCAST has that role now. There are just too many people in the administration. And you know what? That's wonderful. I think it's great that there's a cacophony of views and ideas, because it allows the president and the entire cabinet to really hear these different perspectives, and occasionally they're all in sync. And then you really have a strong sense of what is going on. I think that's a very vibrant thing for our government. It's a very unusual situation. I can't recall a government in any major country in the world where you could say that, you know, three or four of the top 20 positions in the government were all filled with scientists, PhD scientists. That's extraordinary. I mean, Margaret Thatcher being a chemist is sort of an unusual situation. But beyond that.
We started with the talk you gave at the Santa Fe Institute, which was had some doomsday kind of aspects to it. I know that you have two small children. You're obviously invested in the future. I mean, there must be some optimism on your part.
Well, doomsday doesn't mean that we're all going to have a miserable time. I think right now, if you had to be honest about the future of the world, you'd have to say that climate change is going to bring a lot of suffering to the world, and a lot of suffering to natural ecosystems as well as to people. Unfortunately, a lot of that suffering is going to fall disproportionately on people who are already suffering today. The fact is, it's pretty rotten to be poor in sub-Saharan Africa today. You know, there are people dying from poverty today, and there will continue to be. And what climate change may mean is that those numbers will increase. That doesn't necessarily mean that everybody's lives will be miserable. I do think there is a broader ethical challenge that's beyond a cost-benefit analysis from economics, whether it's the Stern Report or Nordhaus or somebody else who's thought about this problem, to look back and say, you know, 100 years from now, 200 years from now, 500 years from now, decisions we made completely transformed this planet, wiped out countless numbers of species from natural ecosystems, caused hundreds of millions, even billions of people to suffer greatly more than they would have otherwise. And because we wouldn't pay for the alternative, it's very difficult to get people to solve a problem that is not immediately upon them. We do very good at reacting to emergencies. It's very difficult to react to something that's in the future. Our political systems aren't set up for this, and I think our psychologies aren't set up for this. So that's why climate change poses such a grand challenge, because it's asking us to do something far off in the future. It's also the ultimate free rider problem. You need everybody in the world to cooperate. It's a very grand challenge, and that isn't to say that I think the world is all going to be miserable. I think that's a mistake. I think people had that sense from Paul Ehrlich's book. And I think that's actually not quite fair to Paul. He was saying there were going to be a lot of people who died from starvation. And luckily there weren't. But maybe in the future there will be again.
Have you ever thought, one last thing here, do you ever thought about doing anything other than science? You're obviously impassioned by science, but I noticed there's wonderful etchings, paintings, and so on in the room. Signed Kurt Schlag, who I gather was your grandfather, so who was an artist who was in Paris in the 30s and so on. There's some artistic tendencies there in the family.
Yeah. It turns out, those scientific tendencies were not passed along. So no, I have no inclination towards the arts, except that I appreciate them and admire them. I have two little children right now, as you said, and that is more than a full-time career for me right now. Just getting any sleep at all is a luxury. And so it's hard to imagine doing anything else right now. You know, for me, science, and especially being at Harvard where there's so many interesting things going on, it's a way of reinventing myself every week. I can work on new problems, new questions, and I'm incredibly fortunate to have that luxury of being able to explore new ideas. So I feel like if we want to call what I do science is a great vehicle to continually reinvent myself. So I don't think of it as stagnant, and therefore it's hard to imagine doing anything else. I feel like I already am doing something else. Every day I'm doing something else. And so that's sort of the way I think about it.
What are you optimistic about?
Well, that's a tough question. I'm optimistic about many things. I actually think we are going to solve the climate problem. I have to admit that there's a chance we won't, but I think we might. I think that humans do a lot of wonderful things in the world. We also do some horrible things, but many of us work hard to try to fix them. And so I think we're going to see some extraordinary innovations and extraordinary acts of generosity and compassion over the next several decades. And so I'm hoping that I can encourage them in some small way.
Dan Trank, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you.